Welcome to NSQ, No Stupid Questions, a podcast that asks everything you want to know but wouldn't ask. I'm Priscilla Britton, graduate of Brixton Finishing School, the creators of the Ad Academy, a new online course from industry experts for untapped talent. In this series, I'm talking to industry leaders about what they have learned on the way to where they are today. Here in the studio is Tarek Soufi, Global Executive Strategy Director at Media Monks. Recognised for his unassuming way of solving seemingly impossible problems, discovering super smart angles that expose new opportunities for clients, and inspiring the creation of truly moving work that has both commercial and social impact. Tarek was the brains behind the Brooklyn Brothers Night School, one of the industry's first inclusion initiatives to provide the necessary training to both enter and excel in this profession. Okay, well, do you know what? Should we start the fun stuff?
Yeah.
Let's touch on, like, the proudest moments from your career.
My earliest super proud moment was actually working with one of the most creative agencies in the world at that time to relaunch a brand that was super close to my heart, a brand that I actually genuinely grew up with. And that was 2011, 2012 relaunch of the Adidas brand globally with the All In campaign. Yeah, that was a real one for me where I was like, it was a true passion project, a brand that I'd grown up with. You know, my dad would only ever buy me Adidas trainers off the sale rack, obviously, when I was a kid. But, you know, I grew up kind of playing football, you know, idolizing people like sportsmen and women. And yeah, that was a really, really kind of proud moment for me. I've been lucky enough to have a couple in my career. Another one much more recently was the repositioning of the Financial Times globally. So that I felt the real weight of that brand on my shoulders. But that was a piece of work, you know, with the Brooklyn Brothers, I was super, super, super happy to be a part of. Yeah, I've had lots of those kind of moments. But those are the two that really stick out for me is, you know, when you're passionate about something, you know, whether it's sport when you're younger or kind of, you know, the changing, you know, being a part of changing the face of business when you get a bit older, passion projects, the ones that you really, really care about, are the ones that kind of live with you. You know, they also tend to be the ones that you throw your heart and soul into. So yeah, those two really kind of stand out to me.
And with like it being a passion project and putting so much into it and investing your time and energy in it, is it always smooth sailing?
No, it rarely ever is smooth sailing is the truth. You know, there's no right and wrong answer. There's only good, bad and bloody brilliant. So, you know, every time I work on a project, whether it rings true in terms of, you know, values and kind of principles that I hold myself to, whether it's something that you're really passionate about or not, it's very, very, very rarely smooth sailing. I mean, to make iconic, brilliant work that is timeless, that moves people, that moves culture, that moves the business and the brand forward, you really need the stars to align. It takes, this is going to sound silly, but it takes a village to make an ad. Yeah, it takes a lot of luck as well. At the same time, you need bravery, you need ambition, you need to kind of roll with the punches, you need to do the best work you've ever done. There's so much that goes into it, and I think often we forget how much actually goes into, for example, making a 30-second piece of communication or making an app or a print ad or whatever it is. It takes absolutely everything you've got, all of your intelligence, all of your energy, all of your luck to make something that you can kind of hold up and be proud of. At least from my own perspective, I have some work that I can be proud of.
Yeah. Going back though to some of the times when you've had to roll with the punches, what would you say have been some of your biggest fuck ups?
There's probably loads of them that I've kind of blocked out of my memory. Well, there was my first. I've changed, I promise. But this was a big one. It was I was working on Reebok. This was the first massive fuck up, and it could have ended my career there and then. And it was in the first month of me kind of working in advertising. I was working on Reebok. I had to take the train up, missed the train, for my first ever client meeting with the VP. And I was just, you know, I was an account exec at that time, and I was described as the worst account exec in the world. Not because of that, because of many other things that I did. But that was a first one, which is, you know, be 2 minutes early, not 2 minutes late. The train waits for no one. So that's a big one. Lots, you know, I when I say I was described as the worst account exec in the world, I wear that badge with pride because look at me, I've done all right. But my boss was right at the time. I was terrible at it. And, you know, I was that kind of kid where I had to really be into something to kind of apply myself to it. Yeah. Now, as you get older, that has to change because that's not life. Mm-hmm. But as an idealistic young 20-something-year-old, mm-hmm. you know, kind of how I rolled. I mean, mistakes happen all the time. And I say mistakes. I mean, again, all you can do is give it everything you've got. Mm-hmm. That's it. And if you leave it out there, I mean, sports analogies, leave it all out on the field, then, and make sure you've given it your best shot in every single way possible, then you can hold your head up high, right? Yeah. So, yeah, there've been a lot of them. You know, that's just one that lives with me because of the timing of it. People make mistakes all the time. We're human. Clients know that. They make mistakes too. Agency founders, holding companies, everybody knows that. So yeah, that's one of them that really lives with me.
I love that though. That's a great story, I have to say. From a colleague,
I still made it there. I caught the next train. And luckily the VP was stuck in another meeting, so he never knew. So Roy Gardner, if you're listening, I was late on that first one. Sorry.
Beautiful. So going from account exec to global executive strategy director.
Mm-hmm. You can't see me blushing.
What would you like to work on next?
That's a really good question. So I guess, you know, we're really lucky to be working in this industry at this time when it feels like everything is changing. Everything's kind of up in the air. The role of agencies, the role of marketing, the role of brands in broader society. I think we're really, really lucky to be in this industry at this particular time when there is so much change. Lots of it, positive change. Some of it, difficult change. And a lot of it in terms of creating a more ethical, more sustainable, more inclusive world. I think the great thing is that, you know, we're in this industry at this time. If you have a seat at the table, you have a voice and you're able to kind of show everyone what the future of marketing looks like. And I think we're living in the age of authenticity where brands have to not only tell stories and do things, but they have to back up those stories. They have to demonstrate that not only do they make great products, not only do they have brilliantly entertaining brands, but also that they have, you know, a desire to push culture, society, the world, whatever it is, forward. Businesses have the ability to be a force for good. So where do I want to go? You know, I want to work with ambitious people who want to drive real positive change. As long as the end goal is there's a bigger ambition, i.e. for wanting to make a positive impact in the lives of real people, mm-hmm. I think that's what marketing has the power to do. As well as, obviously, sell products. But I don't see the two as mutually exclusive. And that's the kind of stuff that gets me, still, after 2 decades, gets me excited and makes me jump out of bed in the morning. I feel like we're in a really privileged position to be working in this industry at this time. Because in what other industry do you have the ability to talk to millions of people at one time, to change public opinion, to push society and culture forward? In what other industry do you have that mm-hmm. ability? And with that ability comes responsibility. And I think gladly we're moving as an industry into that space more than we ever have done before.
So we touched on your first ever role. And I'd just be interested to know how you got that role.
Yeah, so I actually, not many people know this, but I studied photography at university. I thought I wanted to be a photographer. The truth was, I just wanted to be in the creative industries. Mm-hmm. I then worked as a graphic designer for a couple of years. I was massively average at it. But I think it gave me a really good grounding and understanding of what kind of commercial creativity means. Mm-hmm. And it gave me the vernacular, the language that I needed. It gave me the empathy I needed So once I decided that that probably wasn't for me, I thought, you know what, I think advertising is the one. So I didn't fall into it. I actually went for it, seeked it out. Mm. I ended up in a media agency when I first started. And that was because, again, advertising was just a big, broad term to me. And I didn't know the difference between a creative agency, a media agency. Yeah. I mean, social agencies didn't even exist then, but there were PR agencies. Yeah. So for me, it was just, oh, you're going into work in an advertising agency, and turns out that it was a media agency. So I quickly understood that it was about, you know, the placement, mm-hmm. not the actual, you know, creative product. And I felt totally out of place, to be honest with you. I did it. I applied myself to it. But yeah, it was, you know, I went for lots of interviews, but I think people saw, well, I was very lucky that people saw that I had a bit of potential. So it was, yeah, it was the media world that kind of brought me into it. I'm super happy that I did that because it gave me a real grounding mm-hmm. in terms of what advertising it is. Mm-hmm. I learnt a side of the business that I probably wouldn't have learnt so well if I just started straight in creative agencies. And I was there when comms planning was kind of in its infancy, so it didn't exist. You know, social platforms and brands involvement in them were an incredibly new thing. So, mm-hmm. you know, we were moving from the world of, you know, print TV and out of home into the world we know today, where it's a two-way conversation, not just a one-way, one-directional kind of thing. So I was really, really lucky that I was given the chance to actually become a comms planner in a media agency when social media was kind of in its infancy. Mm. And again, nobody knew what the right thing to do was. One of my first jobs was, what should we do in Second Life? I think older viewers, yeah, Priscilla's looking at me like, what the hell is Second Life? The older viewers will know what Second Life is. It was a virtual world where brands wanted to have a presence, and it was huge, I think, in our industry, and in our industry alone, for about 5 minutes. But yeah, there's one for, I'm showing my age now, there's one for you older people.
Sorry, that's really throwing me.
Google it.
Need to Google. So we spoke about the fact that people could see your potential.
At least that's what I told myself.
I think it's a really interesting one because there will be a fair few people who are looking for their first jobs within the industry and are trying to essentially persuade the hiring manager or whoever they're interviewing with that they do have potential.
Yeah.
So what do you look for in new junior hires?
I mean, this is going to also sound ridiculous. I showed up to my interview in a suit. That's how little I knew about the world I was trying to get into. They probably thought I was absolutely mad. Like, who is this kid showing up in a suit? When I got there, I was like, oh, okay, nobody dresses like this. That's a good thing. What do I look for? Honestly, it's only advertising, but it's super important, right? Like, it's super important to me. It's what I spend the majority of my time doing on a daily basis. So I think that the first thing is you have to really want it. You don't want someone who thinks, oh, I'll come in and just, you know, we'll see if it's for me. I'll give it a crack. It's a highly competitive industry. It's become more and more competitive since I've actually been in it, my, you know, 20 years in the industry. So the first thing is you have to really want it, and you have to really kind of show that desire. Mm. I probably interview more planners and strategists than anything else. So I guess I always look for the ability to think laterally. Mm. So yes, it's about problem solving. Yes, it's about being curious, but it's really about how your brain is wired or how you've trained your brain to work. And for me, that's all about lateral thinking. The second bit about that, beyond, you know, demonstrating that you really want it, is the ability to be able to practice empathy. Mm-hmm. Empathy is hugely underrated, I think, in life and our industry. Mm-hmm. But the best planners are, in my opinion, this is just an opinion, the best planners are, you know, have empathy in spades. And that's because in order to really, you can't experience everything in life, but you have to be able to kind of put yourself in someone's shoes. Think not only about what they're doing, but how they might feel about different topics, subjects, etc. Because that's really what we try and do. I think the best work these days, you know, breaks taboos. Mm. It pushes culture. It makes change. It drives behavior. And in order to be a really good strategist in this day and age, I think empathy is probably the number one human quality that you will need. And being a sensitive human being, being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and go, I wonder how they feel. I wonder what their struggles are. Mm. I wonder what they could use help with. I wonder what, and that's for kind of all people, of all backgrounds, of all demographics, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So for me, that's probably the number one underrated quality in good strategists.
Mm. How do you demonstrate that?
I'm not sure. I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm not sure you can in an interview process. Interviews are really difficult, right? I mean, for both parties, having been on both ends, you know, several times in my life, because it's not real. It's not a real process. You're seeing the best of me and I'm seeing the best of you on a good day. And, you know, good days happen now and then. It's not every day. So I think that's a really good question. It's very, I think, very, very difficult for me to answer in terms of how do you demonstrate empathy in an interview? I mean, you can in daily life. Mm. You can, I guess, through conversation, trying to relate to what the question is, what people are asking you, the conversation you're having, etc. But yeah, I'm not sure if there's a true answer for that, to be honest, in terms of how do you demonstrate empathy in an interview. Just like either you are or you're not, and that's definitely something that people can work on. You're not, yes, I think actually do think you are born empathetic, but it's whether or not you're able to hang on to that as a kind of human being.
Circling back to something you said about the industry becoming more competitive, what do you think is driving that?
Lots of factors. I think CMOs are under more pressure than they've ever been to deliver tangible, provable results that trickles down to agencies who then become under pressure. There's a whole procurement thing going on in terms of like how we get paid for the work we do. And then there are more agencies than they've ever been. Pitching for work is a highly, highly, highly competitive sport. And then if you are even trying to get into the industry, there's only a certain amount of roles for juniors. And that's really tough. I think back when I started, it was probably easier to get into the industry than it is these days. Mm. But I think that's changing. I think people realize that cognitive diversity is super important as well, right? Like we need lots of different kinds of people who have lots of different kinds of experiences for us to really make the work that can, going back to the first thing I said, help prove the value of marketing for CMOs on the client side. Mm. The more cognitively diverse we are as an industry, and that's, you know, I'm talking about cognitive diversity, let's talk about diversity in general. The more diverse we are as an industry, the better the work, the more effective the work, the better the CMO looks. So, you know, it's all interconnected. Yeah. But I guess coming back to that idea of why is it so competitive, I guess the world is going through a lot of change in terms of like, are the jobs that are around now still going to be around in 10 years? I think creative industries, common knowledge that yes, that will be around and it will be a highly valued skill. So, and competition's not a bad thing. I think it's great. Like we need competition. We need the best people in our industries. Mm-hmm. I say the best people. What does that even mean? But, you know, we do need competition to make sure that we're getting the smartest, most empathetic, most wonderful human beings in our industry.
Thinking about the people within the industry, what do you think the impact of the increased competition has had on like individuals and how they're able to look after themselves?
I mean, the industry's changed in lots of really brilliant ways. A lot of the stuff that was kind of under the surface, hidden, is now being talked about more openly than it ever has been before. Advertising has always been hard work. I remember when I started, it was a very, very different industry, socially as well as, you know, from a work perspective in terms of the type of work you do. But even culturally, like agencies have changed massively. We're not there yet, you know. I think there's still lots of work to be done, but it's changing for the better. In terms of, you know, what kind of effect has that had on people? Yeah, there are lots of people in our industry who have suffered from mental health because of the pressure that they feel. You know, I think, and the good news is people are talking about it much more openly. Very senior people come out and say, you know, I've struggled with this, I've struggled with that, et cetera, et cetera. For working mums as well, it's been really hard. And these days, great, like working dads as well. But raising a family, working in this industry, looking after yourself, these things aren't mutually exclusive. And we're coming into a much better period where agencies are putting the right processes in place, the right culture in place for people to actually handle that stuff much better. Because what isn't going to go away is the pressure. Mm. But how we handle it, how we look after each other, the things that we put in place to make sure that we as human beings can thrive in that kind of culture, mm. that's what's important. I think that's what's changing for the better, obviously.
Yeah. And it feels like there is more of a awareness of what's going on with people in agencies and just making sure that they're looking after themselves and just encouraging.
Yeah, and that's not, you know, purely altruistic. Like an agency is only as good as the people in the building. If you're only as good as the people in the building, well, you have to make sure that you're giving those people the best possible chance they can mm-hmm. to make the best work they're capable of making. That is truly about, you know, getting the best out of people and having a culture where people can thrive in. Mm-hmm. Part of that comes with, you know, ensuring that your staff are looking after themselves, that they are getting the help they need when they do need it, that they feel like they can talk about it and they won't be penalized further down the road. I mean, because that's, at least when I was a lot younger, if you know, you didn't talk about that kind of stuff at work. You didn't kind of ask for help because of fear of judgment. Like, you know, you always thought people would look at you and be like, ah, that person can't hack it. You know, they can't take the pressure. And there's a lot of pressure, right? Creativity on a deadline. Like, where else in the world does that try and happen and work? Like, more often than not, you don't crack it immediately. Occasionally you do, but that's where a lot of the pressure comes in. And it doesn't matter if you've been doing it for 40 years or 4 minutes. That pressure is real. And the good news is that I think the leaders in this industry, the people at the top, are actually the ones who recognize the need for change.
Just following on from that, what are some of the things that you do to recharge?
I'm just laughing because I wrote a thing in campaign about it a couple of years ago, and it was at the very beginning when, you know, senior people were starting to talk about, you know, the importance of mental health in the workplace. What do I do? Breathe. Like, take a deep breath is like the first thing. Things like this have never helped me. When somebody goes, oh, it's only a job, it's just advertising, like, you're not saving lives. And it's like, that has never helped me, because I've always kind of gone, yeah, but, you know, I spend so much time doing this, it's really, really important to me. Mm. And genuinely, I do think I'd use the word advertising loosely. I do think advertising is important. You know, in what other industry do you have the ability to talk to millions of people, to sway public opinion, to change the way people behave for the better? So, yes, I'm not saving lives, but yes, I think it's important. It is to me, at least. So that kind of comment has never really helped me. Whether it's when I was, you know, a bit younger, I mean, exercise was always the thing for me, like go out, go for a run, kick a ball, play a sport, whatever. In my older years, I'd say nature is probably the best thing. This is going to sound so stupid. There's a lot to be learned from trees in terms of being grounded, in terms of being firm, but swaying with the wind. You know, trees move. They don't just like literally crack and fall over. That you've kind of got to roll with the punches, roll with the flow. Mm. Pets are wonderful, always in the moment, you know. Like, there's a lot to be learnt from nature and the real world. So also, all of this stuff is in your head, and you have to look after that. You have to know when to walk away from something and give it a bit of space. You need to know when to breathe, I guess. It's such a personal thing, because it's going to be different for every single individual in terms of like how you look after your mental health. Mm-hmm. For me, I could say spending 2 minutes with my cat and stroking him brings me back to reality and grounds me. You know, there's things that are scientifically proven, like meditating. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge advocate of that. So, but I think the most important thing is that people find the tools that work for them. And I say tools, it could be anything. Nature could be a tool that works for you. Meditation could be, sport, fitness could be, you know, having a conversation with somebody could be. Mm. You've just got to find the things that work for you, because we're all different.
Mm. I think that's really interesting because as well, like a lot of those things are around what you can do to bring yourself back into the moment and feel grounded. And it's almost like one is a maintenance thing to maintain your mental health, but two is also to bring you down when you feel like things are moving really quickly and it's all really fast and you need to slow down that pace. But what do you do to move in the opposite direction? What do you do to feel inspired and to lift your spirits?
Well, I guess inspiration can come from anywhere. That's the truth. I don't really seek it. For me, it's about taking lots of stuff in and then inspiration brings it out at the right point in time. Mm-hmm. So the things that we all do, like spend time with friends, talk to real people, watch TV, watch Netflix, go to a gallery, read a book. Like, it's all about taking as much as you possibly can in from different kind of point of views, right? So I think this, I'm not really into reading stuff that I would wholeheartedly agree with every single time. It's about different perspectives. It's about seeing the world through different people's eyes. And then the inspiration is, for me at least, the moment that that experience, conversation, passive viewing experience comes to the forefront. Mm. And then you go, aha, like now I know what to do with that. Yeah. And for me, so inspiration isn't something I consciously seek out. Mm. It's not something I do on a daily basis. Mm. I mean, you know, this experience will probably come to me at some point in the future and inspire me, or, you know, set a spark going for either another experience or something that I'm working on. Or so for me, it happens every day, all day. And it only becomes inspiration when it, in that moment, when you go, aha, like I remember that thing, or et cetera. So the human brain is a fascinating thing, right? Yeah.
That and we know able little to build about those connections at the time you need it.
Yeah, totally. And you know, at the time you need it. Yeah, not always.
not always.
Yeah, but that's at least with being a strategist, that's and you know, I guess all of us, like strategy, account management, creative designers, producers, like we talked about, like creativity on the timeline is incredibly difficult, and that comes with a huge, huge, huge amount of pressure because it's your heart and soul. Whether it's a brief or an idea or an execution or a script, or it's your heart and soul. Mm. It's you on a page. It's your voice. It's your thoughts. It's your opinion. It's your beliefs. Mm. It's your talent. Mm. And that's where the pressure comes from, right? At least internally. External pressures, fine. But internally, for me, that's where it comes from. It's me on a page. And you put yourself out there. And sometimes you get there and sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's less good.
Just on that.
Yeah.
I suppose one of the campaigns that you worked on was the Sainsbury's Christmas ad. So the idea of reading perspectives that are not always what you agree with and being open to those and exposed to those, it created a lot of conversation.
Yes.
It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on on that.
Yeah, so okay, what I won't do is speak for Sainsbury's or Wieden & Kennedy. Mm. I was I felt hugely, hugely lucky to work on that brand and to work in that agency and to do a Christmas campaign. I mean, what a privilege. Mm. You know, none of that was by design. The conversation around it took me by surprise, and that made me feel really naive, is the truth. I don't think... maybe there were other people that saw it coming, et cetera, but I just felt, you know, totally naive. Mm. When, you know, you and I spoke about it, when the conversation was going off, I think actually you might have been the first person I called. I was like, have you seen this? Madness. But yeah, I mean, it's a really funny thing because what did we do? Nothing. We just made a series of inclusive ads about people celebrating Christmas over food. I've worked on briefs where we're like, right, we're going to tackle this taboo. We're going to take it forward. And we're all like, hell yeah. And this wasn't one of those. It was, right, we want to be the most inclusive retailer in the country. Well, cool. Let's start with representing the country in a holiday period with food in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And it was about families. And food has the power to kind of take you home. Mm-hmm. And a time when actually that's all we wanted was to go and spend time with our loved ones. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that one of the wonderful families was a black family. And that's why, for me, it wasn't something we really talked about at length. It was 100% natural. It was like, well, we're representing the country. There we are.
Yep.
There was some backlash.
Yeah, there was backlash. And it's still, like, to be honest with you, I still struggle to get my head around it. Here's the weird thing. So I'm Lebanese originally, born and raised in London, but... You know, I am an Arab. Both my parents were Lebanese, moved here during the Civil War. My dad was Muslim, my mum Christian. I actually lived in the States during 9/11 at the height of Islamophobia. But I look very European. I look 100% Mediterranean. If I'm in Portugal, people think I'm Portuguese. If I'm in Italy, they think I'm Italian. Wherever I go, people think I'm from that country. So when I was living in the States, because of the color of my skin, the way I look, maybe the way I dress, the way I sound, I was privy to a lot of hateful conversations around Arabs at that time, and people didn't know where my name was from, for example. So they would openly talk to me and say racist remarks. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what we're going through globally and within this country is so difficult to talk about, because it's like everyone's experience of it is going to be different. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great that it's being talked about more than ever. Mm-hmm. It's sad that I was watching a thing with John Barnes the other day, England international, and he was saying nothing's changed in 20 years. Mm. You know, and he's 100% right. At least, you know, he was one of the first black footballers for England, and he's right. Like, again, even that, I was like, wow, you know, he's right. Like, it hasn't changed. It's bubbled up again. It's being talked about more, and that's because we're seeing it pop up in different kind of aspects of life, whether it's, you know, in football stadiums or through advertising or whatever it is. And that's a great thing, but it's really, like, absolutely shocking that nothing has changed in so long. Mm. I think businesses and brands like Sainsbury's were, the way they dealt with it was absolutely phenomenal, I think. Mm. And that's because it came from human beings. Mm. It wasn't a business decision. It wasn't anything. It was just pure humanity from the people that worked there shining through. Mm. And that is a really good thing. So, yeah.
Think that black people are being overrepresented in advertising?
I don't think so. Can I be really honest? Not something I've thought about. Mm. But then again, maybe that's naive. Here's the thing: whenever you're trying to change something, the pendulum usually swings in entirely the opposite direction to an extreme. I'm not saying yes in terms of your question, but what I am saying is when you're trying to change something, it's human nature to try and swing it to the other end. Within time, things tend to always balance out. I haven't been conscious of it. I don't know the numbers in terms of, like, because you would have to take a scientific kind of approach to it. Like, what's the percentage of the population? And then what's the percentage of representation in advertising? I don't have those numbers. I can't say. My gut goes, no, I don't think so. It seems pretty even, pretty fair. If we are, then so be it for now. You know, because we're trying to change. We're trying to change things. And that's what's important to me, is that people feel represented, you know. People feel like they have a chance. And sometimes you have to see yourself. You have to see yourself in something to believe that you can do it. And, yeah, to feel like you're part of something. So I can't answer the question, but what I can say is if it is, then that's where we are and so be it. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. And like,
what do you think? Can I ask you what you think?
Yeah, I think black people are being overrepresented.
Okay.
And I think it is exactly what you said is the reason why. Is because I think advertisers are seeing an opportunity as an audience they haven't been speaking to try and build loyalty there. Mm-hmm. But it's like every brand is trying to do that, and every brand is going, oh, we need to be more representative in our advertising.
Yeah. And I think, I hope, so this is, I'm an eternal optimist, to my detriment sometimes. But I hope that that's coming from a place of humanity, not business. Mm. Now, the truth is probably that it's a mix. Mm. That's probably the truth because, you know, it's commercial creativity. Like, we're using creativity to help grow businesses and brands. Mm. And if that's a community that's been underrepresented in the past, then yes, you're right. Like, it would appear that there is an opportunity for growth mm. with an audience. I would like to think that it's more people are more aware of the underrepresentation in the past mm. and think if we really want our brand to be part of culture, well, then we need to show the culture. Mm. We need to show reality. And I think we're coming into a kind of, you know, in advertising at least, this is truly, in my opinion, the age of authenticity. Mm-hmm. Like, if you do not behave in an authentic way, you will be found out. Mm-hmm. And I think whether or not people see it as a business opportunity or not, I think if they're not being authentic about it, then they will be found out and it will backfire. So yeah. That's all good. Yeah. It'll work itself out in a weird way. But yeah, authenticity is kind of king. And I think as an industry, we're starting to realize that. And that's because of where we are as a country and as a culture, young and old. You know, we want brands to be authentic. We want them to make a difference. We want them to, you know, champion the values and make a difference in the world.
100%. And I think it's also interesting that it extends beyond what we see on screen. So it's not just the films that we're seeing and big TV spots, it's the people behind the work as well.
Yeah, which is hugely important, like hugely, hugely, hugely important. Yeah, and you talked about, you know, how you're right, like in order for us to make work that truly represents the people of this country, then it's a really simple equation. Then your offices, your production teams, your people behind the camera, your directors, your producers, your editors, your sound people, like, you know, we have to represent mm-hmm. and we have to, you know, represent the country. And, you know, luckily I'm a born and raised Londoner. London's one of the most diverse cities in the world, and advertising currently doesn't represent at least London mm-hmm. from that respect. But yeah, we're on a journey with it, I think, and it's not going to be solved overnight. There isn't a magic kind of silver bullet, but as long as people have the right intentions and are putting the right practices, processes, pipelines in place, then this industry will survive. Otherwise, it will become redundant.
In terms of agencies themselves making sure that they've got the right people in the right places, what would you say for those who are coming in, one of the few? Do you have advice for them?
I would say you're coming in at a great time. Mm. The need for change has never been more apparent, and leaders in this industry have never been more open to it. My advice would be yourself, because that's what people want. Like I said, a lot of the pressure comes from, this is me on a page, this is me in an idea, this is me in a whatever. Mm. And that's what people want. Again, an agency is just people under one roof. Mm. And your work will be representative of the people under that roof. Mm. So not all rosy. I mean, again, agency cultures are changing, and they are not perfect. So there will be moments, there will be experiences that maybe don't sit well for anyone, you know, who isn't of the stereotypical advertising demographic. Mm. I mean, weirdly, I put myself in that bracket as well, but I don't think what you'll find is any resistance. What you'll find is people wanting you to be you and championing that. Mm. And I think that comes from the top again. And I hope that people are encouraged, like they always have been in advertising, to voice their opinions, their hopes, their dreams, their worries, and just be themselves, because that's when you make the best work.
That yes. really works for you.
I've been doing it since I was a young child. This is the other one that no one else can do.
I'm not going to lie, I can't.
It's
do
like
that.
Bird face. Yeah.
All right. Well, as a global executive strategy director, I'm going to keep saying it. it'd be really interesting to hear your point of view on navigating a role in planning. So, if you were starting out in the industry today, what would you do?
I guess the best bit of advice I could give to anyone trying to come into the industry, and then strategy and planning in particular, is you have to start doing. Because it's become incredibly competitive, right? Tens of candidates per role at all of these different agencies, and everyone's looking for that spark that somebody has. And what is that spark? It's so intangible. Mm-hmm. The dark arts of planning are still pretty dark, pretty kind of intangible. How do you show that you can think laterally? How do you show that you've got empathy? How do you show all of that in an interview? The truth is, you probably can't, but what you can do is show it in everyday life through the things that you are doing. Young people are way more motivated today than they were when I was young. We were part of the slacker generation, and it was like slacking was cool. Slacking's not cool anymore, which is a really good thing. So it's about demonstrating your ability with the other things that you do. So, you know, whether you're starting a podcast or not, it's, do you have the initiative to do it? Do you have the intelligence? Do you have the drive? Do you have the personality to do that? Do you have the ability to write really brilliant, tricky questions that people want to hear someone like me answering? It's really about that kind of stuff, I think, these days, because the environment is super, super competitive, because there's so many people going for these entry-level jobs, especially in planning. There aren't that many junior planning roles around. I think what you do outside of whatever job you have, whatever, if you're at university or not, it's the stuff that you do outside of that that demonstrates your ability, your potential, your desire, etc., that I think will set you out from the other candidates. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was coming into the industry, you didn't need that. But nowadays, I would say you do. Mm-hmm. I know there's lots of really brilliant young people in this industry who are actually doing a hell of a lot more than, you know, my generation. And I think that's a really kind of commendable thing. Mm-hmm. It's not only commendable, it's incredible, it's super valuable. Even things like this show that you've got what it takes. So that's what I would say, is your passion, your side hustle, whatever that thing is, bring that to the table, and that will probably set you apart. And if you're not doing one of those things, I would say do it. Find the thing that you're passionate about. Start something, because that will set you apart from other people. And it will showcase your potential, and it will showcase your personality in ways that will be much more difficult to do just through answering questions in an interview. Yeah. If you've got an idea, do it. There's no better proof that you can be amazing at advertising than having an idea, mm-hmm. and actually doing it.
Mm-hmm. 100%. It's also very motivating. I'm sure that a lot of the people listening are going to be super inspired and pumped up and ready to see their ideas come to life. But if they've done that now, they've got through the interview stage and they've landed their first role, what would you suggest that people do once they're in the door?
I guess this hasn't changed. People have always said about strategists, planners, your job is to be useful. Like, yeah, of course it is. But I guess for me, being useful has always been about building. When I say building, I mean being the energy in something, seeing the potential in something, helping to make it as good as it possibly can be. If you're doing that, if your desire is to build an idea that you feel has real potential, if that's your desire, then your behavior will follow suit. Mm. You will go the extra mile. You will do everything you possibly can to build that idea. Mm. That, I think, is what is expected of everybody in an agency. Gather around the idea that gets you excited, and then let's build it. Let's give it the best chance of living. Let's de-risk the investment that clients have to make in it. Let's push it creatively. Let's stay true to it. Let's look after it. And if you have that desire, the energy will come. Like, at least that's what I've always practiced. That's what I still see that as my job today. And yes, it changes at different points in the process, but I still see that as my job. Like, my job is to champion creativity, to create an idea that can drive somebody's business forward and society in some kind of way, whether we call that culture or society or whatever. But I guess that's my best piece of advice, is always bring that building mentality to the table. Mm. Everything will follow after that. You'll want to be useful. You'll want to find the insight. You'll want to go the extra mile. You'll want to write the inspiring brief. You'll want to say that thing that just unlocks it for somebody. You know, if you have that desire, the rest of the behavior will follow. And I think that's probably the most important thing when you're starting out and, you know, when you've been doing this for a while.
I'm not going to lie. I was really in the moment. I don't have a thought.
You wrote a sentence down.
I did. One thing on that is, yeah, there are ways to be useful and create that energy and momentum to make sure everyone is like pushing to create amazing work. But are there other things that influence the kind of work that you'll create, like the agency you're in?
Yeah, the agency you're in, the philosophy of that place, the way it views creativity, the people that you're working with, everything will influence the work, right? And that's because it's nascent in a way, it's intangible. So it will be influenced by everything around it. The energy you bring to the table every time you talk about it will influence whether it is amazing. The agency will influence the type of work that you make. And that's because the people in that agency, the clients, will influence the type of work that you make. But I guess when you're starting out, for me, the one piece of advice I've always given people is choose a boss. Because the most important thing when you're young is learning. As long as you're learning, as long as you're growing, as long as you're evolving, not only professionally but also personally, then the rest of it will come. You will be good at what you do. The stars will align for you one day and you will make some great work that you can be really proud of. So that's what I always say, is choose a boss, not an agency. Worry less about the agency, worry less about the type of work they're creating. But all of that stuff will influence the type of work you make. The opportunities, the way you're seen by your clients, the things they think you're good at, the things they think you're not so good at. And early on, it's all about learning, right? It's all about like the journey to realizing your potential. That's what I've always kind of seen it as. I've stayed in some agencies for 7 years. I've stayed in others for 2. Because as long as I'm learning, more so in your latter years, you know, as long as I'm learning and as long as I'm evolving and the work is something that I can feel proud of, I mean, that's, you know, you have to take responsibility for your work. So whether or not you think it's good, well, that's, it's not entirely down to you, but, you know, you had a seat at the table. So as long as you're doing that, as long as you're learning, as long as you're growing, I would say you're in a good place. It will influence the type of work that you make, without a doubt, like the agency will, because the people will and the clients will. But if you don't have a seat at the table, you can't be part of the conversation. You can't change it. You can't drive it forwards.
So understanding the difference between your role and then the role of somebody who's junior.
Yeah. I mean, the macro task is the work. And then that's broken out into lots and lots of micro tasks. So the role of a junior planner is going to be different in every single agency that you go to. And that's because it will be dictated by the opportunity in front of you, the projects, and also the person you're reporting into. I always say, like, my job is to give people opportunity and then to be there to support them so that they smash it. And that opportunity is different for every individual depending on where they are in their journey. I guess it's always about trying to show value. So even if you're doing a competitive review, it's not really about like what other people are doing. It's about finding the space, finding differentiation, finding where not to go, et cetera, et cetera. And it's applying that thought process to any task is how you show the true value. And that's because really that's about the way that you think. One of the most important things I was told when I was a junior planner was get a clear brief. Because if you don't get a clear brief, you don't know what to look for. You don't know how to approach it. You have to get clarity up front. And that's part of being a good boss. And it's part of being a good, you know, junior planner as well. It's like, make sure you get that clear brief. What are you looking for? I know what you're asking me to do, but what are we looking for? Because that's when you can start to prove the real value. It's not the task that's valuable. It's how you approach it and what you come to the table with after you've done it that is really what's valuable.
Does that need an air of confidence? Because I think some people don't know what they should know versus what to question and ask for more information over.
But so yes, it is partly confidence. And maybe this is just me, but the funny thing about planning is it definitely makes you feel insecure on a daily basis. because there is no right and wrong answer. There's only different degrees of good, interesting, different, whatever it is. So just remember, actually, the confidence comes from doing a brilliant job. And in order to do a brilliant job, you've got to be clear on what people are looking for. Not just clear on the task. Here is the job I would like you to do, but understanding why, understanding what you're looking for. I mean, that's still true to this day for anybody in this industry. Understanding why is probably the most important thing, because sometimes there's a better way to do something that someone hasn't thought of. And that doesn't matter if the person's got 30 years experience or much less. Mm. That's the whole point of having lots of different kinds of people in agencies, is that everyone will approach it in a different and unique way. And that is the thing that is valuable. Mm. Your perspective on something is valuable. Yes, in some tasks like competitor review, there are right and wrong, because there is what this brand is doing. It's based in fact, but actually the bit where there's no right and wrong is the thing that you do with it after. And that is the real value. So in any kind of task I was approaching or I'm approaching, I would always go, what's the real thing that we're trying to do here? Where's the opportunity? I know a lot of planners talk about defining problems, etc. That's a huge part of the job. But I think modern planning is also about creating opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I would always have one eye on that. Where's the opportunity in this task for this brand, for this business, for this product, for this service, whatever it is? Where's the opportunity? Because that's what the best planners do. And that's why creatives still love working with some of the best planners.
So a competitor analysis is the task that you'd expect a junior person in the team to look after.
One of.
Yeah. What are your day-to-day responsibilities?
Been a lot kind of talked about this in the industry in terms of when you get to a certain level, isn't it funny that you get removed from the actual job that you've become really good at doing? I've been lucky that whether I was CSO of a place or a planning director at a place, I tried to be at the kind of coalface of actually making. That's what excites me. You know, on a day-to-day basis, yeah, you deal with people. A big part of the job is, how do you get the best out of your team? How do you get the best out of every single individual who is different, who is motivated in different ways, who is scared by different things, who is insecure about certain things? And every single individual is different. To know how to get the best out of them, you have to know them personally. You know, you have to really kind of get under the skin. So that's a big part of it, is how do you get the best out of your team? What kind of culture do you want to build? And that's about being a leader, right? And you can be that no matter what position you're in. It doesn't matter if you've been in, you know, an agency for 2 minutes or much longer. Leadership isn't a job, it's a personality trait. And you can be that. You can create the culture that you want to be in. So I've always kind of seen that as my job. Now, it becomes more important when people look at you in that way or look to you for those kinds of things. So when you're running a department, yes, it's all about people. It's all about the culture. It's all about the processes. And then the job, I'm still a strategist. I'm still a planner. So I still get a kick out of writing briefs. Mm-hmm. I still get a kick out of having conversations with people about where we should take this thing. Mm-hmm. I still get kicks out of going, how are we going to give it the best chance to live in the real world? Mm-hmm. I still really enjoy showing it to clients and making them feel like they can't miss out on it. This is the thing that is going to create real value for them. I still get a kick out of all of that stuff. And that's why there's nothing like the feeling of seeing your work in the real world or hearing somebody talk about it. Seeing comments sometimes on social media, like good or bad, where it shows that the work you've done is creating a conversation that needs to happen, or you've done something that actually real people can see value in. So yeah, I've been lucky that some of the work that I've done has done that. And it's that that I find really, really exciting about my job. And I've been doing it for a while, you know? So what I mean by that is that it's still exciting because every brief is different. Every opportunity is different. That's the brilliant thing about advertising. Very rarely will you come across an opportunity where you go, oh yeah, okay, it's one of those ones. I know exactly what to do on it. If you're pushing yourself, it should feel new and different and exciting every time. So yeah, as you get more senior, it becomes more about people, looking after your people, making sure you're getting the best out of them, etc., etc. But the job is still the job, and for me that's about creating opportunity, creating the space for amazing ideas to come to life, to flourish, and then de-risking the investment in that brilliant piece of thought and making it in the real world.
As a global executive strategy director with 2 decades worth of experience, I'm sure you've created some amazing work. Could you tell me what your proudest moment?
Quite an intro, Priscilla. 2 decades. Yeah. I guess one of the proudest was relatively early on in my career, when I was at Sidley in Amsterdam working on Adidas and relaunching the brand in 2011 before the Olympics in 2012 with the All In campaign. You know, it was a real privilege to essentially reposition and relaunch a brand that I grew up with, one that was like a real part of my childhood. I mean, I only ever wore Adidas trainers growing up. I mean, that was my brand. You know, while the rest of the kids were going crazy for Nike Airs and Jordans, I was proudly wearing the three stripes. So that was a huge privilege very early on in my career. I'm really proud of the work. I still look at it and go, yeah, that was pretty good. Mm. Did it change the world? No, probably not. Did it become part of culture? Were people talking about it? Yeah, definitely at that time. And that was really one of the first projects where I could hold up my hand and go, man, I was part of that team that made that wicked thing, and I'm super proud of it. I still talk about it today because it was a huge thing for me. I'm lucky that I've been given opportunity, and I think that's really what it's about. So whether it was, you know, the work I did with the Brooklyn Brothers at repositioning the Financial Times, like imagine that, the weight of that on your shoulders. Like here's a hugely famous, massively influential, global business driving, changing entity that is on the desk of every single CEO across the world. How do you deal with that? And you know, you're coming off an iconic positioning with We Live in Financial Times, which at that time was hugely, hugely resonant in culture for a brand like that. But again, it was also a brand that needed to change. So I was really proud of the work that we did and that agency, the Brooklyn Brothers, are still doing around holding big business to account in terms of the new agenda and the work we did on that. So that was one where I felt the real kind of wow, like look at this is a pretty cool one. Those two kind of stick out for me as really proud moments. And then, you know, doing a Christmas campaign at one of the best agencies in the world for, you know, a massive brand in Sainsbury's, that was a nice moment for me as well. But you know, you look back on career sometimes and you go, yeah, I was lucky more than anything else to be given those opportunities, or to found myself in the right place at the right time to be given those opportunities. So yeah, I'm lucky that I've had a few moments like that in my career. Not all of them. There's a bunch of stuff that I'll try and erase from memory, but that's part and parcel. You know, if you smashed it every time, then it would be an easy ride.
Could we retrieve some of those memories that you're hoping to forget? Let me know what you've learned from some of your biggest fuck-ups.
So one of them was my first job in planning was as a comms planner on Reebok. And I was described as the worst account exec in the world at that time. So I was the account exec on Reebok. I went on to be the junior planner on that account. God knows what they were thinking, but luckily they saw that I had enough potential. My first meeting, going up to the Reebok Stadium in Bolton from Euston Station, I literally called my manager at the time and said, oh, I'm just running a bit late, I'm stuck in traffic. And he said, well, the train's going to leave in about 3 minutes. As I ran to the platform, stepped one foot onto it, I saw the train pull away. And I think it's probably about a 4-hour train journey or 3-hour train journey up to Bolton. And I remember calling him and being like, I've missed the train. So that was a couple of months in, and that was my first massive client meeting, and I missed the train. Luckily, I got on the train after. I actually made it there 15 minutes late. But yeah, it was with the VP of Reebok at that time. So if Roy Gardner is listening, sorry, I was 15 minutes late to my first ever meeting when I was an account exec on your bit of business. I don't think I've ever missed another flight or train in my career. But there have been lots of other moments like that. I mean, you know, that's a throwaway one. Sometimes people are late. But I'm sure when I was an account exec, I'm sure there were a few media plans where the numbers didn't quite add up. And I probably cost a few companies a couple of £1,000 here and there. There were probably moments in pitches where you get things massively, massively wrong. Probably briefs I've written over time that actually were just way off. So yeah, you get things wrong all the time, but I think in advertising, at least, there's always been a culture of you should be able to feel like you can fail. And that's a really good thing. At least I've always been encouraged to fail and to get it wrong. I've been told at numerous times in my career, you don't always have to be the one that has the answer, which is invaluable. So yeah, I'm sure there've been lots of fuck ups, but most of them have been erased from my memory.
Where would you like to go and create moments that you're proud of and mess things up just a little next?
So I guess, you know, we're really lucky to be working in this industry at this time when it feels like everything is changing. Everything's kind of up in the air. The role of agencies, the role of marketing, the role of brands in broader society. I think we're really, really lucky to be in this industry at this particular time when there is so much change. Lots of it positive change, some of it difficult change, and a lot of it in terms of creating a more ethical, more sustainable, more inclusive world. I think the great thing is that, you know, we're in this industry at this time. If you have a seat at the table, you have a voice and you're able to kind of show everyone what the future of marketing looks like. And I think we're living in the age of authenticity where brands have to not only tell stories and do things, but they have to back up those stories. They have to demonstrate that not only do they make great products, not only do they have brilliantly entertaining brands, but also that they have, you know, a desire to push culture, society, the world, whatever it is, forward. Businesses have the ability to be a force for good. So where do I want to go? You know, I want to work with ambitious people who want to drive real positive change. As long as the end goal is there's a bigger ambition, i.e. for wanting to make a positive impact in the lives of real people, I think that's what marketing has the power to do. As well as, obviously, sell products. But I don't see the two as mutually exclusive. And that's the kind of stuff that gets me still, after 2 decades, as you said, still gets me excited and makes me jump out of bed in the morning. I feel like we're in a really privileged position to be working in this industry at this time, because in what other industry do you have the ability to talk to millions of people at one time, to change public opinion, to push society and culture forward? In what other industry do you have that ability? And with that ability comes responsibility. And I think gladly we're moving as an industry into that space more than we ever have done before.
No Stupid Questions, a podcast brought to you by the Ad Academy, a new online course from industry experts for untapped talent to help you understand how the creative industries work. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. And remember, success isn't always getting it right, it's learning. Until next time, goodbye.